This is case 55 from the Heikigan Roku. Taiwo's condolence call. Introduction. Secure and intimate with the whole of reality, one obtains realization right there. In contact with the flow, able to turn things around, one assumes responsibility directly. As for cutting off confusion in the light of a stone-struck spark or a flash of lightning, or towering up like a mile-high wall where one occupies the tiger's head and takes the tiger's tail, this I leave aside for the moment. Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path or not? To test, I cite this case. Look, the case. Tao and Qian Yuan went to a house to make a condolence call. Yuan hit the coffin and said, "Alive or dead?" Wu said, "I won't say alive, I won't say dead." Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" And Wu said, "I won't say." Halfway back, as they were returning, Yuan said, "Tell me right away, teacher. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you." Wu said, "You may hit me, but I will not say." Yuan then hit him. Later, Tao passed on. Yuan went to Shi Shuang and brought up the foregoing story. Shuang said, "I won't say alive, I won't say dead." Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" Shuang said, "I won't say, I won't say." At these words, Yuan had an insight. One day, Yuan took a hoe into the teaching hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east. Shuang said, "What are you doing?" Yuan said, "I'm looking for the relics of our late master." Shuang said, "Vast waves spread far and wide. Foaming billows flood the sky. What relics of our late master are you looking for?" Zuetu added a comment saying, "Heavens, heavens." Yuan said, "This is just where I should apply effort." Fu of Taiwan said, "The late master's relics are still present." The verse. Rabbits and horses have horns. Oxen and rams have no horns. Nary a hair, nary a wisp, like mountains, like peaks. The golden relics still exist right now. With white foaming waves flooding the flooding skies, where can they be put? There is no place to put them. Even the one who returned to the West with one shoe has lost them. This building we're in, which serves as a dojo and a zendo, is a great teacher for us. For the past 22 years, it's been holding the space and supporting countless classes, seminars, ceremonies, celebrations, memorials. In a quiet and constant way, it provides the underlying foundation for all our gatherings. And it welcomes and supports us unconditionally, regardless of the state of mind we're in or the current state of our circumstances. There is room for everything and everyone. We come in, make all kinds of commotion, and leave. Yet it remains unfazed. We laugh, we cry, we fall, we get up. It remains unfazed, ready to take on whatever comes. ready to nurture, ready to support. To being so consistent this way. What is this space teaching us about living and dying? About our arising and vanishing. I have the privilege to be in this space before anybody shows up. And usually after everybody leaves. And it's quite palpable, that silence, that care, that deep sense of compassion that is being offered. An incredible teacher it is. So what is it teaching us about impermanence? Now, a conventional view of impermanence tends to be emotionally charged, and we typically may prefer to avoid the topic. As Jifu mentioned, Jifu, our head trainee, mentioned in the last workshop she was leading, our society offers many ways to ignore and suppress it, so we can pretend to be living in a different kind of reality. However, when we take the time to slowly turn towards the impermanent nature of our existence, it actually begins to appear more as a supportive friend rather than a threatening foe. More as an ally, with rather than against. Impermanence means, doesn't mean what we think it means. It actually means eternal continuity. Eternal continuity, rather than a beginning and an end, which is our limited view. We see it from a very personal perspective. It's not impermanence as much as my own impermanent nature and the impermanent nature of those I love and care about, the immediate circle. How limited is that, right? In terms of understanding such a fundamental aspect of our existence. How limited we are in the way we approach it. So it means eternal continuity that is always supporting us, like the constant background hum that is being offered in this space. We just are so loud, even when we are silent, we are very loud, that we just can't hear it. But there is this constant hum in the background all the time. And it's there for us, not against us. It is a kind of teaching that points us to what gives rise to birth and death. So we can realize our unborn and undying nature. In the process of opening our eyes, the eyes to this truth, and realize it through personal experience is a long path, which inevitably comes with painful challenges. But the alternative of ignoring reality and keep your eyes closed is much more painful, isn't it? If we're willing to be honest. You know, we say that the practice is radical, right? And it is. It is offering a very radical view of life. But it's radical because we are radical in our current view of life. Because we go against what we are. So the practice actually is not radical at all. It seems radical because of our stuckness, our insistence of holding on to someone, to the idea of someone, of seeing someone as unchanging. That's radical and futile, we might add. So either way, we go against, we go with, we cannot escape dealing with the matter of life and death. It's not a choice. And the question is, do we understand the urgency of this matter? As you know, in the inscription on the Han, it says, life and death are of supreme importance. This is a quote from Dogen. And we hear it over and over again. Some of us chant it over and over again every day. And the point of the escalating beats on the Han and the repetitive words of the Eno is to make sure that we understand that the most important, vital part of our practice is to intimately dive into a deep inquiry of life and death. It is of supreme importance since all other inquiries are secondary and we all are subjected to that, a part of that, all of that. What other inquiry can take the place of that? And not only that, it has the way we are dealing with it, opening the eyes, closing the eyes to it, affects everything. Everything we do. So we can say that our practice is teaching us how to die well so we can learn how to live well. Dogen says that both life and death are of supreme importance. He's saying it to mess with our conventional and logical way of thinking that embraces life and rejects death. This is how we think. But this simple statement says that if we reject death, we reject life. So if we want to fully embrace life, we must also embrace death as an integrated aspect of our existence. Not as an experience that we need to go through now, but as an integrated aspect of this moment. Because birth and death are inseparable aspects of our lives. The division between the two is only a result of our emotional and psychological interpretations. And, of course, our grasping mind. And the study of impermanence is not just an inquiry into birth and death. It is, again, about our realization of life as a continuous expression that has no beginning and no end. And as such, it simply cannot be fixed. How can it be? So following that, any fixed idea we have about ourselves or about others cannot be more than rigid mental image created in the mind. It simply cannot. Most of you have heard it many times, read it many times. But the question is, what does it mean, or what are the implications of that now? Because even after years of practice and even after years of hearing and chanting this, we still experience a gap between what we think we may understand and then the way life shows up for us, or the way we react to the way life shows up. There is still a gap. there's still a discrepancy. So if there is a thought arising in your mind right now, I've heard this before, watch out. Because that could be your trap. Better say, I have not heard that before. So then maybe I can go deeper in the way I experience such statements. So if nothing can be fixed, if reality is marked by impermanence as a continuous, non-stop flow with no beginning and no end, then we have to bring up Uman's important question. Where do you find yourself? Where do you find yourself? We have to ask. Right? Because if we don't ask, we take for granted. And if we take for granted, we cause harm. That's not in question. So we have to look. What is it? Where am I? What am I? What we call Buddhism was born out of the Buddha's deep inquiry into exactly that, into impermanence as a fundamental characteristic of life. And that's the same inquiry we take on as a vital part or aspect of our practice. We need to do what he did. Because if we don't, then what are we practicing? What are we upholding? What is the practice about? So we need to, each of us, need to find the courage individually to dive deeply into this and give birth to Buddhism on a personal and intimate level. We give birth to Buddhism. Kensho, enlightenment inevitably passes through this gate. There is no other kind of realization. There is no, I'm going to realize and I'm going to feel good. Because in realization, nobody realizes anything. Because if you find yourself as the one that had a realization experience, then there it is again. There it is, the fixed. Which was deluded and now is realized, which we thought before was deluded and now we think is realized. And it has to be today. It has to be now. It cannot be later. Kabir, 13th century Indian mystic, said, what you call salvation belongs to the time before death. If you don't break the ropes while you're alive, do you think ghosts will do it after? In other words, what are you waiting for? What are we waiting for? I'm working on it is what we often tell ourselves and others, right? I'm working on it. What does that even mean? I'm working on it. Now, if you tell somebody, wake up now, well, I'm not ready to wake up. You are not in my shoes. I got issues to work out before I can wake up. But this is not saying wake up to something. It's just wake up now to the way things are. Wake up to what you are turning away from. Do it now. Whether our eyes are open or closed, either way, we are all subjected to the same law of impermanence. The difference between living in acceptance or denial shows up in the way we encounter each moment and the kind of consequences that will follow. It is about the difference between bondage and freedom. and between that which is harmful and that which is beneficial. That's why it's so urgent. In the introduction, it says, secure and intimate with the whole of reality, one obtains realization right there, in contact with the flow, able to turn things around, one assumes responsibility directly. And this is our job description, isn't it? Right? In contact with the flow, able to turn things around, one assumes responsibility directly. So right now, in contact with the flow, but I'm stuck, is what we may think. What does that mean, I'm stuck? Who is stuck? Maybe I feel stuck. Fine. Who is stuck? We have to ask. It's not that the feeling of stuckness is not there. But who is stuck? 10K commented on this, saying, the transcendental state of secure stability is originally hidden within ourselves, where complete reality is uniquely manifest, immediately present, and completely immutable. Students should realize this on the spot. Now then, when it comes to entering the flow to transform things, suddenly responding to myriad conditions, not getting trapped in any state of existence, taking up the responsibility directly, this refers to the activity proper to a Zen practitioner. That's what we are asked to do. It's not that I'm asking you to do it. This is what you are asking of yourself to do when you turn towards a wisdom tradition and practice. That's what that means. Whether it's the first day or after 40, 50 years, it doesn't matter. It's the same practice. To meet reality as changing and to change, to correspond to the changing reality by being changed ourselves. Then there's no gap. Then there may be a feeling of stuck, but there's nobody who is stuck. So to be secured, intimate with the whole of reality means to fully accept and embrace all of it without judging, dividing, or creating a personal story of what happens. To be in direct contact with the flow means to be fully present, bear witness to what comes. Now, bearing witness always includes internal and external in terms of what's happening in me, in relation to what's happening here. Bearing witness, that's it. Just that. That's what we do in Zazen. We bear witness. We learn to bear witness. Unconditionally, without judgment. Just bear witness. That's what that means. So fully present to that, whatever comes. So the introduction is telling us to keep returning, to keep return to oneness. We chant that. What we have to practice that, return to oneness on a momentary basis, especially when there is a strong feeling of aversion and pain. And all we want to do is just run away from the experience. But where do we go when we run away? What do we go from? What do we go towards? What do we go towards? Can we escape? In The Hazy Moon, Bernie Glassman wrote, a lot of work has been done in recent years in hospital, especially with people who are terminally ill with cancer and who are in chronic deep pain. The work from a variety of approaches centers on training the people to become one with the pain. These experiments have been very successful in that the people who have really involved themselves in the training generally die very differently from the people who have not been able to become one with their pain. It's apparently something that can be learned or taught. The key here is all oneness, and he's saying it as one word, all oneness. Eliminate the distinction between yourself and others. At the moment of being hit, there is no suffering. There's not even knowing that you're hit. At that very moment, there's no distinction and there is no suffering. It doesn't mean that a rock doesn't land on your head. When the rock lands on your head, it really hurts. Of course it really hurts. Still, at that moment, that's all there is. You don't think, oh, a rock came down and hit me on my head. It's just the pain. That sudden happening in that state of oneness, it doesn't mean that you rid yourself of things you see or feel in dualistic state. If you see a person on fire, you feel his suffering, he's burning up. But when there's really no separation between yourself and that suffering, there is no you left to suffer. And that's totally being merged with the flow. But merged with the flow is not merged with a good kind of flow or my good kind of flow. It's just being merged with whatever arises. It's just being merged. So it's like, you know, when you think about babies, right? The state of being of a baby. So I was talking to Asa actually a few days ago, and Sam was not feeling too well, right? So he was congested. He's a newborn. So he was congested, and, you know, and I saw him on Zoom. So you could see that he's, you know, having difficulty breathing and congested and all that. So there's definitely the congestion. But he's not there to say, I wish I was not congested, right? I mean, not yet, anyway. There is that merging. It's not that we have to invent it. We all know how to do it. We were all there. So there is definitely that discomfort. But there is nobody who is experiencing and commenting and judging that state of being. So it's a kind of freedom, no? Right? Freedom from the one who is outside of life and death and pointing at it and saying, I like this, I don't like that. I wish it was different. So what happens to us? We grow up and then we lose the ability. I mean, obviously cognition plays a big role in that, but is it cognition or is it the way we are using cognition? I mean, we can't blame it on the intellect or our ability to think. We can, but there is another way to look at that. So what he's saying here, he's not saying that it is easy, right, or difficult. He's not saying either easy or difficult, Bernie Glassman's comment. All he says is that we must practice over and over again, right? We have to practice to a point that we embody a different way of functioning. And it is obviously a form of training. Or untraining, we can say, right? To untrain ourselves from the way we have become trained and to go back to the way we were or the way we are. And we need to do it with all the time, especially with the small irritations, right? It may be easier to work with it when we are slightly irritated before we go into the big irritations, right? The slight irritation, to be constantly aware, what kind of state of mind is it now? right? Is it drifting? Am I starting to become entangled? Am I starting to become too involved in something that just happened or happened 5 or 10 years ago? Right? To become aware and then come back to nothing. Not come back to something, oh, I should be focused on that and suppress this. No, I come back to nothing. Because here in nothing, there is no one who will point a finger and complain. We come back to that. We veer off, we come back. That's what we do. That's what we train ourselves to do on the cushion. So the introduction continues. As for cutting off confusion in the light of a stone-struck spark or flash of lightning, or towering up like a mile-high wall where one occupies the tiger's head and takes the tiger's tail, this I leave aside for the moment. Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path or not? So don't try to achieve something you have in your mind. Just look at the practice as it is. Leave it aside, leave everything aside, and look at the practice as it is and ask, does this work? Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path or not? This is an important question to look at, because what is it that we practice? What do we call Zen? Is it a skillful way to awaken people? How do we do that? How do we use the practice? And this is asking, he's posing this question, or the introduction is posing this question in relation to this koan, right? Referring to the way Tao Wu dealt with Chen Yuan's question about life or death. Life and death. In this koan, Tao Wu and Chen Yuan went to a house to make a condolence call. So they both showed up, and probably the first time Yuan is there, seeing dead body. So Yuan hit the coffin and said, alive or dead? And Wu said, I won't say alive, I won't say dead. And Yuan said, why not? And his teacher said, I will not say. Just that, I will not say. You can adjust if needed. So I won't say alive, I won't say dead. Halfway back, afterwards, they were on the way back to the monastery. Yuan said, tell me right away, teacher. He really wanted to know. Not because he wanted to amuse his mind. Not because he was asking about Zen. He was terrified of his own mortality. We understand that. We get it. We understand why he was so insistent. I want to know. Tell me. Is it done or does it continue? Which is it? So he said, if you don't tell me, I'll hit you. He said, go ahead. Still, I won't tell you. So he did hit him. Tao was a 9th century Zen master who, in this occasion, went to pay respect to family who lost loved one. And Chen Yuan was one of his disciples who came along as his attendant at the time. So this is just the background about that, right? And he came, they went in together, and he came as his attendant, but then while he had the job to do, there was something going on. There was this unanswered question that he probably thought he will get an answer for by tagging along. So I won't say dead, I won't say alive. Now why didn't he help his student clarify this most essential question? Or did he? Was he helping him by refusing to help? By refusing to go along with that way of thinking? By intercepting the way we think? The question that is, what do we expect from a teacher? And what do we expect from our own efforts? No, it's very clear, you know, my experiences with both Zen and Aikido was always very clear for me that my efforts are extremely important. So being exposed to different teachers, yeah, there's a lot to get, there's a lot to clarify by studying with teachers. But then all of it is turning it around and asking ourselves, now what do I do? Not relying on a teacher, but allowing the teacher to point us to ourselves, and also being willing to hear from a teacher what we may not want to hear. Instead of arguing back, listen. In most cases, Dharma teachers are interested in helping. Even when it doesn't appear this way, that's always there. So if we are triggered, or if some words may seem harsh, or if we don't even understand, like, how can you say that? Here's what I'm doing. How can you say I'm not doing that? We have to stop and take a look at what's going on. So instead of pointing a finger, we have to turn it around and ask, am I aware enough? Or how can I expand or deepen my level of awareness? My teacher can guide, support, encourage, and mirror, but ultimately the responsibility to break through entanglements and realize liberation has to be on each of us. So Tao refused to say it is dead. And he refused to say it is alive. Then what is it? Right? In the realm of language, there are divisions and opposites. So if it's not dead, it must be alive. And if it's not alive, it must be dead. Either I continue or I die. Either I'm eternal or ephemeral. Tell me. But words create is just give us the illusion of rigid absoluteness. And we may feel as if they are verifying reality. It's just the seeming sense of absoluteness. And then we go along with that. Of course, it is like this. Of course, I am like that. And that's what we have to work with, to examine what is it. The words may sound this way, but is it this way? So every time we go to the words to find some sense of clarity, we only become more confused because reality is impermanent, unfixed, undefined, ineffable. Words cannot relay that because they speak in such way, or they appear in such way. Is not, before, after, in, out, you, me. So we actually believe that the words mean more than just a way for us to communicate with one another. We make a lot more than they are. We make from them a lot more than what they are. So if we want to align with what is changing, ineffable and undefinable, what we have to do is change something in the way we view it. In other words, we need to change and shake the absoluteness of our mental constructs or question what seems to make sense. We chant no old age and no death and no end to old age and death. And it sounds like contradiction, doesn't it? Since it's affirming and denying in the same sentence. But all it is saying is that the division and dualities are only conceptual. And we're going to need to find a way to be okay with things being perceived as contradictory. It's okay for the mind to say, this makes no sense. It's okay for the mind to say, I want either this or that. Don't give me both. Because I don't know, I don't have a place for that. It's fine for the mind to say it. But we just have to be careful not to think that the mind is going to verify reality by doing so. Now we expect our life to follow a plan. Then we look for security in such expectations, but in reality our lives do not follow any preconceived plan. And we have no choice but to face the unexpected on a momentary basis. That's why it says in the introduction, secure and intimate with the whole of reality. Unconditionally secure and intimate with the whole of reality. Not security that comes from getting what I want, avoiding what I don't want, accumulating this versus that. There is no security. It's all falling apart anyway. The footnote to this exchange praises Yuan's persistence and says, if he hits Tao, he'll be getting somewhere. It is rare to meet a pierced ear traveler. That's referring to Bodhidharma. You often encounter travelers who cut a notch in the boat. If you are like the latter, you'll enter hell as fast as an arrow. And you've heard this example before, right? If you drop, so it's soldiers traveling in a boat and one of them dropped a sword as the boat was moving and then marking the boat so he can go back and find the sword. So that's what this is from. And then it says, the other footnote, after he hit him, it says, he should be hit, but say, why does he hit him? From the beginning, there have been people who have received unjust beatings. Throughout the history of Zen, teachers have been rebuked for being stingy and withholding something from the student. And as long as students abdicate the responsibility, there is no way to dismiss the expectation that the understanding will eventually come from another in some form of explanation. And so Tao gets hit, although at the end, it is realized as unjust. Because he does realize later on. So later, after Tao died, Qian Yuan was still looking for someone to answer his question. And he went to see Shishuang, his older Dharma brother, and brought up the same story, asked about it. And Shishuang said, I won't say alive, I won't say dead. Yuan say, why not? And Shuang said again, I won't say, I won't say. Now, at these words, Yuan had an insight. Then he had a realization. He's asking the same question, getting the same answer. Yet at this point, something shifted. And the footnote says, though his words are the same, his intent is different. But say, is it the same as or different from? He's asking before. So the way he asked before, is it the same as or different from? When the eyes open, they open to what was there all along and will be there all along. The opening or closing of the eyes, the seeing or not seeing, realizing or not realizing, have nothing to do with continuity or with the impermanent nature of our life or with our true nature. We do cause a lot of issues before the eyes open up, and after they open up too, to some degree. But something changed. The one thing that I think we need to probably keep in mind in this is that he did not quit. Probably most important for us is that, however this his teacher dealt with the question, however Shishuang dealt with the question, he kept going. Because he kept going, he was able to break through. Not because of anything else. And Shishuang knew that. I mean, he was like, well, I'm not going to say. And Shishuang didn't know whether or not at this time Yuan will have realization. But he did know. He did realize that if he gives him something, he's going to give him something, another illusion to put his hat on or to stand on. And he refused to give him anything to rely on. There's already enough that we come in relying on, enough conceptual images and stuff that we rely on. Why would a Dharma teacher give us more? So either take away what you rely on, or at least not give you something new to rely on. That's the teaching. That's how the teachings are preserved, actually. So Shishuang said exactly what Tao Wu said, but at this time, Jian Yuan listened in a different way and was able to hear what he could not comprehend before. Or maybe he was not so preoccupied with his own thoughts, his own mind, because often what happens is that we are so loud, as I was saying before, that we cannot hear anything other than ourselves. We hear ourselves, react to ourselves, and then whine about it, but point at others as the culprit, right? That's our specialty. We cause the issues and blame others. That we are very well trained in. So I may not understand, I may feel fearful and discouraged, but I'm not going to allow my confusion to deter me from staying on the path, is what we need to keep going with. I feel lost. I don't get it. I don't even know why I'm still showing up. That doesn't matter. None of it matters. Show up, practice, sit, keep going. Because that's all that matters. It's not, I heard the words of this teacher and that's going to make the difference for me. Maybe, maybe not. And even if it does, still, maintaining it is on you. So you cannot keep running back to the words of a particular teacher and hold on to that. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's only up to you, us. So the second part of this koan, one day Yuan took a hoe afterwards into the teaching hall and crossed back and forth from east to west, west to east. And Shishuang said, what are you doing? Yuan said, I'm looking for the relics of our late master. He was the teacher of both of them. So Shishuang said, vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the sky. What relics of our late master are you looking for? And Zuetu added comments saying, heavens, heavens. And Yuan said, this is just where I should apply effort. So what is he looking for? What are we looking for? Xixuang tries again to clear his doubt and says, vast waves spread far and wide, foaming billows flood the sky. What are you looking for? It is only your thought that is holding you back. So instead of dwelling in thoughts, go directly to reality and realize on your own. There's a similar line from a different footnote from a different koan that says, give up recollection. What limit is there to the pure wind circling the earth? One of my favorite lines. Give up everything because you have everything. Give up the pettiness so you can realize the richness. And this is the reason why we don't realize how vast and rich we are is because we are so tiny in our way of thinking. We're so petty. He said this, she said that, I'm not going to forgive this. There's so much nonsense that is taking a big chunk of our energy and attention. And that energy is needed for our own journey back home. How are we going to get there if we are, well, I should ask this, where is our attention and what are our priorities? Right, by coming to a practice center, we need to ask, what are my priorities? Back to the Han, what is it saying? It is saying something, but does that work with the priorities I hold on to? Or this is for the ones who have realized, I got stuff. So in the fascicle titled Shoji, Dogen says, it is a mistake to think that we go from being alive to being dead. That's how we think. That's our entire way of thinking. Right there he says, this is a mistaken view or mistaken way to see reality. Being alive is a position at one moment in time. It already has its past and will have its future. Therefore, within the Buddha Dharma, we say that life is beyond just the act of being born. Life is beyond just the act of being, life is beyond just me being born and dying. Death is also a position at one moment in time, and it too has its past and its future. Accordingly, we say that death is beyond the act of just dying. In the time we call living, there is nothing except life. And in the time we call dying, there is nothing except death. Thus, when life comes, it is simply life. And when death comes, it is simply death. When facing up to them, do not say that you want to cling to one or push away the other. It's all we're saying, really. This living and dying is precisely what the treasured life of a Buddha is. So, that line, right? This living and dying, this one living and dying on this cushion is precisely the life of a Buddha. So, where are the relics? What are we looking for? Where are we looking for that? Verse, rabbits and horses have horns. What? This must be a mistake. Oxen and rams have no horns. Nary a hair, nary a wisp. Like mountains, like peaks, the golden relics still exist right now. With white foaming waves flooding the sky, where can they be put? There is no place to put them. Even the one who returned to the west from with one shoe has lost them. Now, I just want to read a few words from Tenke about that. When it comes to this lost article, the relics, they say that Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, went back west to India and that the relics were lost at that time. But did they exist before Bodhidharma or not? So the story about Bodhidharma, after he, the founder of Zen, after he died, he was buried, and afterwards somebody who came from India to China said that he ran into him, to Bodhidharma, going back to India. And he said that he had one shoe, one sandal. So then they went back to the grave place and they dug it out and they found one sandal. So this is what this story is from. But even he has lost it, is what it's saying. So did he exist? Do they exist before Bodhidharma? Did they exist? Or are they non-existent? Is it existent or non-existent? Alive, I won't say. Dead, I won't say either. Look for the late teacher's relics right where you are. Every one of you. That's still Tenke. Ultimately, Secho's meaning is that Bodhidharma didn't come from India to China while alive and didn't return to India from China and die. Every individual's nostrils are the relics of the late master, not in the grip of even the Buddhas and Zen founders. Ultimately, it is neither existent nor non-existent. And this is our problem. This is what we refuse to get or to trust. It is neither existent nor non-existent, yet it is both existent and empty. Neither one nor different, apart from the four propositions of logic beyond the 100 negations. The realm of total immutability. Also, the expression rabbits and horses have horns referred to what is meant by putting a head on top of your head. You've heard this, right? Many of you. The expression oxen and rams have no horns means the same thing as cutting off your head in order to live. Also, Dogen saying, I thought there was fundamentally not a single thing. Who would have known the whole world has never concealed it, has the exact same meaning as the relics of our late teacher being nary a hair, nary a wisp. Not to be considered nothing, being massive as giant mountains, being the relics that have never been concealed anywhere in the whole world. So it has never been concealed. We, each one of us, is what has never been concealed. Each one of us, neither existent nor non-existent. And the point in that, again, all of it has to do with consequences. It's not a philosophical discussion we should later on talk with other people about and ponder and compare. And all of it comes down to the way we are and the consequences that we create. Because if it is truly neither existent nor non-existent, everything changes. Your entire priorities immediately will change. Think about it. What would you be vested in? Or would you be vested in everything you're vested in if it is neither this nor that? And all of it has to do with bondage and freedom. That's why it's so urgent. I'll just end with a line from Rumi. This place is a dream. Only a sleeper considers it real. Then death comes like dawn, and you wake up laughing at what you thought was your grief. Thank you.